Side 7, The Hidden City, The Tomilly, Book 3, by David Eddings, continuing on page 220. Tell Lord Scarpa that I won't cause any problems. I'll pick one of these empty buildings a little way off from his main camp, and clean it out, and fix the roof my very own self. I'll provide my own security, and make sure that none of his soldiers gets too drunk.
Go ahead and get started, Master Senga, Krieger said, eyeing the cask. You've got my personal guarantee that Lord Scarpa will agree.
He reached out for the wine. Senga stepped back. After, Master Krieger, he said firmly. At the moment, I'm filled with appreciation. The gratitude comes after Scarpa gives his permission. Then Elrond came hurrying across the crowded square.
Krieger, he said in a shrill voice, come at once. Lord Scarpa's in a rage. He's commanded us all to meet him at headquarters immediately.
What's the matter?
Krieger rose to his feet.
Sazada just came in from Seneska. He told Zalasta and Lord Scarpa that Clell went to have a look at the fellow we've been following all this time. It's not Sparhawk, Krieger. Whoever it is looks like Sparhawk, but Clell knew immediately that it's somebody else.
Chapter 16.
I know it's him, my lady,
Aileen insisted.
Aileen, dear, Ilana said gently, he doesn't look the least bit like Sir Calton. I don't know how they've done it, but that's Calton out there in the street, the girl replied. My heart sings every time he walks by.
Ilana peered through the little opening in the window. The man looked like an Aileen. There was no question about that. And Sophronia was a magician after all.
The thought of Sophronia filled the queen's eyes with tears again.
She straightened, quickly wiping her eyes.
He's gone by, she said. What makes you so sure, dear? A thousand things, my lady. Little things. It's the way he holds his head. That funny way he rolls his shoulders when he walks. His laugh. The way he hitches up his sword belt. They've changed his face somehow, but I know it's him.
You could be right, Aileen,
Ilana concluded a bit dubiously.
I could probably pick Sparhawk out of a crowd, no matter whose face he happened to be wearing.
Exactly, my lady. Our hearts know the men we love.
Ilana began to pace the floor, her fingers absently adjusting the wimple that covered her head.
It's not impossible, she conceded.
Sparhawk's told me about all the times he disguised himself when he was in Rendor, and spheric magic might very well be able to change people's faces. And, of course, if Sophronia hadn't been able to do it, Belium certainly could have. Let's trust your heart and say that it is Sir Calton out there.
I know it is, my lady.
It does stand to reason, Ilana mused.
If Sparhawk's somehow found out that we're here, he'd most definitely want to have some of our friends close by when the rest of them come to rescue us.
She frowned as a thought came to her.
Maybe he doesn't know for sure, though. Calton might just be here to look around. We have to come up with some way to let him know that we're here before he gives up and moves on.
But my lady, the girl with the huge eyes protested, if we try to call out to him, we'll put him in terrible danger.
She bent and looked out at the street again.
He's coming back, she said.
Sing, Aileen,
Ilana exclaimed suddenly.
What?
Sing. If anyone in the whole world would recognize your voice, Calton would.
Aileen's eyes suddenly widened.
He would, she exclaimed.
Here, let me watch his face. Sing your soul out, Aileen. Break his heart.
Aileen's voice throbbed as her clear soprano reached effortlessly up in aching song. She sang My Bonnie Blue-Eyed Boy, a very old ballad which Ilana knew held special significance for her maid and the blonde Pandion. The queen looked out the window again. The roughly dressed man in the street was standing stock still, frozen in place by Aileen's soaring voice. All doubt vanished from Ilana's mind. It was Calton. His eyes streamed tears, and his expression had become exalted, adoring. And then he did something so unexpected that Ilana was forced to revise her long-held opinion about his intelligence. He sat down on the mossy cobblestones, removed one shoe, and began to whistle an accompaniment to Aileen's song.
He knew, and he was whistling to let them know that he knew.
Not even Sparhawk could have responded so quickly
or come up with so perfect a way to convey his understanding of the situation.
That's enough, Aileen, Ilana hissed. He got our message.
Aileen stopped singing.
What are you doing there?
One of the Arjunais who guarded the door demanded, coming into view.
Stone in my shoe, Carlton explained, shaking the shoe he'd just removed. It felt like a boulder.
All right, move on.
Carlton's altered features took on a truculent look. He pulled his shoe back on and stood up.
Friend, he said in a pointed sort of way, you'll be getting off duty before very long, and you might just decide to stop by Senga's tavern for a few tankards of beer. I'm in charge of security there, and if you start pushing me around here, I might just decide that you're too rowdy to be served when you get there. Understand?
I'm supposed to keep people away from this building, the guard explained,
quickly modifying his tone.
But politely, friend, politely. Every man in this whole place is armed to the teeth, so we all have to be polite to each other.
Carlton threw a guarded glance at the barred window from which Ilana watched.
I learned politeness when I took up with Shalag. You know him, don't you? The one-eyed fellow with the Lochaber axe?
The guard shuddered.
Is he as bad as he looks? He asked.
Worse. He'll hack your head off if you even sneeze on him.
Carlton squared his shoulders.
Well, I guess I'd better be getting back to the tavern. As my friend Ezek says, 'tain't hardly likely that I'll make no profit lollygagging around in the street. Come on by the tavern when you get off work, friend. I'll buy you a tankard of beer.
And he went off down the street, still whistling My Bonnie Blue-Eyed Boy. Treasure him, Aileen, Ilana said, her heart still soaring. And don't let that face deceive you. He gave me more information in 2 minutes than Sparhawk could have in an hour. My lady?
Aileen looked baffled.
He knows that we're here. He started to whistle along while you were singing. He also told me that Sir Bevier and Kaalador are here with him.
How did he do that?
He was talking with the guard. Bevier is probably the only man in Derisia right now with a Lochaber axe. And his other friend sounds just like Kaalador. They know we're here, Aileen. And if they know, Sparhawk knows. We might as well start packing. We'll be leaving here shortly and going back to Mytherian.
She laughed delightedly and threw her arms around her maid. Carlton tried very hard to keep his face expressionless as he walked back along the moss-covered streets toward Senga's tavern. But the excitement kept bubbling up in him, and it was very difficult to keep from laughing out loud. Scarpa's army had cleared the northern quarters of Natayos and restored the buildings there to some degree of habitability when they had first arrived. But most of the city was still a vine-choked ruin. Senga had considered several possible sites for his tavern, and had rather shrewdly decided to set up operations some distance deeper into the old city to avoid interference from officious sergeants or junior Aline officers with deep convictions and not much sense. He had chosen a low, squat building with thick walls but no roof, a deficiency easily overcome with tent canvas. He had considered hiring off-duty soldiers to clear the brush out of the street leading from Scarpa's main camp to the tavern door, but Kaalador had persuaded him to save his money.
There ain't no need, Senga,
the disguised Camorian had told the harried businessman, reverting to his dialect.
Them thirsty soldiers'll clear the street for us their very own selves, without no money changin' hands at all.
The tavern crouched in the ruins, indistinguishable from nearby buildings, except for its canvas roof and the crudely lettered sign reading Senga's out front. Carlton entered the tavern through the side door and paused to let his eyes adjust to the dimmer light. The place was moderately crowded, even at midday, and the 6 aproned outlaws from Narstal's camp hustled back and forth behind a rough plank counter, drawing foamy beer and collecting money. Carlton pushed through the noisy crowd, looking for Bevier and Kaalador. He found them sitting at a table on the near side of the room. Bevier's sawed-off Lochaber and Kaalador's stout cudgel lay in plain sight on the table as a sort of constant reminder to the assembled revelers that while having a good time was encouraged, there were strictly enforced limits. Carlton carefully lowered himself onto the bench, keeping his exuberance tightly bottled in. He leaned forward, motioning his friends closer.
They're here, he said quietly.
Kaalador looked around the tavern.
Well, he drawled, not quite all of them, but most likely everybody who's off duty. I'm not talking about this crowd, Ezek. I'm talking about the house with the barred windows. The people we've been looking for are definitely inside that house.
How do you know? Vivier demanded in an intense whisper. Did you see them?
I didn't have to. One of them is a very special friend of mine, and this friend recognized me, even with this face. Don't ask me how.
Are you sure?
Vivier pressed. Oh, yes. This friend started to sing in a voice I'd recognize in the middle of a thunderstorm. It was a very old song that has a personal meaning for the two of us. Our friends inside recognized me. There's no question about it. This friend I was just talking about only sings that song for me. I don't suppose there was any way you could let them know that you'd received their message, Kalidor asked. Short of tearing down the door, I mean. No, I didn't have to tear down the door. I whistled along. I've done that before, so my friend knew what I was trying to say. Then I struck up a conversation with one of the guards, and I slipped in enough hints to let our friends inside know the things they ought to be aware of. Kalidor leaned back in his chair. Your idea about this year tavern's working out real good, Shalad. We've been a-picking up all sorts of useful information since we settled in. Colton looked around the tavern. Things are quiet right now, he said quietly. The fights probably won't start until the sun goes down. Why don't we take a stroll back into the ruins? I think we'd better have another chat with that certain little girl. This time we've got some good news for her. Let's get at it, Kalidor said, rising to his feet. He pushed his way through to the counter, spoke briefly with one of the foam-soaked outlaws, and then led the way outside. They went around behind the tavern and pushed their way along a vine-choked side street that ran past some fallen buildings where bright-colored birds perched, squawking raucously. They went into a partially collapsed ruin, and Colton and Kalidor stood watch while Bevier cast the spell. The Serenic was grinning when he came out. You'd better brace yourself, Colton, he said. What for? Athriel plans to kiss you into insensibility the next time she sees you. I suppose I can live with that. I gather she was pleased. She almost ruptured my eardrums. Well, as she always says, we only live to please those we love. Scarpa was screaming even before he came through the door. His voice was high and shrill, his eyes bulged, and his makeshift crown was askew. He was clearly in the throes of hysterical rage. His lips and beard were flecked with foam as he burst into the room.
Your husband has betrayed you, woman, he shrieked at Aelana. You will pay for his perfidy. I will have your life for this.
He started toward her, his hands extended like claws. Then Zelasta was in the doorway.
No,
he barked in an icy tone. Scarpa spun on his father.
Stay out of this, he shrieked. She is my prisoner. I will punish her for Sparhawk's treachery.
No, actually, you won't. You'll do as I tell you to do.
Zelasta spoke in Alenic, and all traces of his accent were gone now.
He disobeyed my orders. I will make him pay.
Are you so stupid that you didn't expect this? I told you how devious the man was. But your mind's so clogged with cobwebs that you wouldn't listen.
I gave him an order!
Scarpa's voice had risen to a squeal. He stamped his foot. Then he stamped the other. Then he began jumping up and down on the floor, quite literally dancing with fury.
I am the Emperor! He must obey me!
Zelasta did not even bother to use magic this time. He simply swung his staff and knocked his hysterical son to the floor, sending his crown rolling.
You sicken me, he said in a voice loaded with contempt. I have no patience with these temper tantrums. You are not the Emperor. When you're in this condition, you're not even meaningful.
His face was unemotional, and his eyes were remote.
Have a care, Scarpa, he said in a dreadful voice. There's nothing in this world that I love now. You have freed me from all human attachments. If you annoy me, I'll squash you like a bug.
Scarpa scrambled away from the terrible old man, flecks of foam speckling his face. "What's happened?" Elana asked anxiously.
"One of my associates, Cizada of Issos, just arrived from Seneca," Zalasta replied calmly. "He brought us some news that we probably should have expected. Your husband's a devious man, Elana. We thought that we had him, but he managed to wriggle free."
"I don't understand."
"We left him instructions when we abducted you. He was supposed to take his squire and set out on horseback for the town of Beressa in southern Arjuna. We had people watching, and he seemed to be obeying. He was not, however. Evidently, he's not as fond of you as we thought he was."
"He was simply following my orders, Zalasta. I told him that under no circumstances was he to give up the Bellium."
"How did you manage that?"
Zalasta seemed actually startled. "Your lunatic son here told Elrond to kill Baroness Meladir. Elrond's a hopeless incompetent, so Meladir was able to deflect his sword thrust. I have some remarkable people working for me, Zalasta. Meladir was able to play dead very convincingly. I feigned hysteria and managed to whisper instructions to her while I covered her with a blanket."
She gave him a rather malicious sidelong glance.
"Your mind must be slipping, Zalasta. You didn't even notice that I no longer had my ring. I left that with Meladir as well."
"Very resourceful, Elana," he murmured. "You and your husband are stimulating opponents."
"I'm so glad you approve. How did Sparhawk pick you?"
"We're not entirely sure. We had people watching him from the moment he left the Imperial compound in Mytherium, and he followed our orders to the letter. We even diverted him a couple of times to prevent any tricks. Then Clell escaped again, and went looking for Bellium. The man we thought was Sparhawk was on a ship crossing the Sea of Arjun with his squire Khalad. Clell took one look, and instantly knew that the man who appeared to be your husband was not Annika. That's the news that Cizada just brought to us."
She smiled almost beatifically at him. "And so now Sparhawk's out there somewhere, with Bellium in his fist and murder in his heart, and you haven't the faintest idea of where he might be, and quite probably not even what he looks like. You've got a big problem, Zalasta."
"You're very quick, Your Majesty. You think even faster than my colleagues."
"That isn't very difficult. You're surrounded with defectives. Which particular stroke of my genius is it that you admire?"
He smiled faintly. "I rather like you, Elana," he told her. "You have spirit. My assorted defectives haven't yet fully grasped the implications of your husband's ploy. If he's somehow managed to make someone resemble him, he's surely able to alter his own features as well."
"He does it all the time, Zalasta. He had a great deal of experience with disguises when he was in Mendor. It's all falling apart on you, isn't it? I'd suggest that you start running immediately."
"I'll be leaving shortly, right enough. But you'll be going with me. Tell your maid to start making preparations for a journey."
"What are you saying?" Scarpa scrambled to his feet. "She can't leave here," he shrieked. "We're going to make the exchange here."
"You imbecile," Zalasta sneered. "You didn't really think I was going to let you go through with that, did you? I never had any intention of letting you get within 5 miles of Bellium."
Scarpa gaped at him.
"It was a misguided attempt to save your life, idiot. Bellium would have destroyed you in the instant that you touched it."
"Not if I had the rings. They would have protected me." Scarpa's eyes were wild again.
"The rings are a fraud,"
Zalasta sneered.
"They have no power over Bellium whatsoever."
"You're lying."
"You desperately want to believe that, don't you, Scarpa? You thought that all you had to do to gain control of the most powerful force in the universe was to put on a pair of rings. Gwerig the troll dwarf made the rings at Bellium's instruction. They were designed to deceive a troll into thinking he had some power over the jewel. Bellium induced Gwerig to make the rings, and then it tricked Athriel into stealing them. Everyone's attention was so fixed on the rings that we didn't even bother trying to steal Bellium from the royal crown of Thalesia."
Scarpa suddenly sneered. "You just outsmarted yourself, old man. If Bellium's so deadly, how is it that the kings of Thalesia could touch it and not die?"
because Belium's alive, you dolt. It has an awareness. It kills only those it wants to kill. And that would certainly include you. You're my son, and even I want to kill you most of the time. You had some deranged, half-formed notion that you could just pick up Belium and start giving it commands, didn't you?
Scarpa flushed guiltily.
Can't you get it through your sick head that only a god or Annika can safely take up Belium and start giving it orders? I realized that over a century ago. Why do you think I made an alliance with Azash, or with Sirgon? Did you think I was having religious yearnings?
He smiled a cruel smile.
Did you really think Belium would have made you a match for me, Scarpa? You were going to put on the rings, snatch up the Belium, and order it to kill me, weren't you? I almost wish the situation were different. I'd have loved to have seen the expression on your face as Belium slowly turned you to stone.
Zelasta straightened.
Enough of this, he said.
He went to the door.
Come in here, he barked. All of you.
The men who entered were fearful and hesitant as they sidled through the door. Quager appeared to have been frightened to the point that he was sober, and Elrond was actually cringing. The third man was a stringy-looking styric with a long beard, shaggy eyebrows, and sunken, burning eyes.
All right, gentlemen, Zelasta said. This new development calls for a change of plans. My son and I have discussed the matter, and he's evidently decided that he wants to go on living, because he's agreed to follow my instructions. I'm going to take the queen and her maid to a safe place. Natayos is no longer secure. Sparhawk could literally be anywhere. For all I know, he's already here. I want you three to stay here with Scarpa. Keep sending those letters of instruction to this counterfeit Sparhawk. Don't let our enemies know that we're onto them. Give me a couple of days, and then send instructions to Panemdia. Tell them to prepare suitable quarters for two very important ladies. Then wait two more days and send a closed carriage down there. Security's an alien concept to those cretins at Panemdia. So word of your message will be all over southern Arjuna almost before your messenger arrives. Sizzata, I want you to keep a close watch over my deranged son here. If he doesn't follow my instructions to the letter, I want you to summon one of the servants of Azash from the netherworld to kill him. Be creative, old boy. Pick the cruelest and most hideous demon you can find. If Scarpa disobeys me again, I want him to take a long, long time to die. And I want them to be able to hear him screaming all the way from here to Mathurian.
Sizzata's dead eyes came alight with a sudden cruel anticipation. He fixed a ghastly smile on the now totally rational Scarpa.
I'll see to it, Zelasta, he promised in a hollow voice. I know just the one to call on.
Scarpa shrank back fearfully.
Where are you going to take the prisoners, Lord Zelasta?
Elrond quavered.
Where can you be safe from that vengeful monster they call Annika? You don't need to know that, Elrond, Zelasta replied. The Pandians have a reputation for severity when they interrogate prisoners. You won't be able to tell them what you don't know, even when they start to torture you.
Torture? Elrond's eyes widened, and his voice came out in a terrified squeak.
This is the real world, Elrond, not some romanticized daydream. The posturing and play-acting are over now, but I'm sure we'll all be impressed by how heroically you endure the agonies they'll surely inflict on you when they catch you.
Elrond fell back in a near faint. Chapter 17. Her Royal Highness, Crown Princess Danae of Alenia, sat pensively on an out-of-the-way window seat on one of the upper floors of her mother's castle. The weather outside was unsettled, and a blustery wind skipped the dead leaves across the lawns below like scurrying brown mice. Danae absently stroked her purring cat as she considered options, alternatives, and possibilities. Mirtai, grim, implacable, and wearing an Aton breastplate of polished steel and black leather, stood several yards down the corridor, her face set in an expression of sullen obedience, and her hand on her sword hilt.
"You're still angry with me, aren't you?"
Danae asked the golden giantess, not even bothering to turn around.
It's not my place to either approve or disapprove of my owner.
Mirtai was being stubborn about it.
Oh, stop that. Come here.
Mirtai marched up the hall to where her capricious little owner was sitting.
Yes?
I'm going to try again. Please listen to me this time.
As your majesty commands.
That's getting very tiresome, you know. We love you, Mirtai.
Is your majesty speaking in the royal plural?
You're starting to make me cross. I've got a name, and you know what it is. We all love you, and it would have broken our hearts if you decided to kill yourself. I spoke to you the way I did, to bring you to your senses, you ninny.
I know why you did it, Danae. But did you have to humiliate me in front of the others?
I apologize.
You can't do that. You're a queen, and queens can't apologize.
I can if I want.
Danae paused.
So there,
she added. Mirtai laughed, and suddenly embraced the little girl.
You're never going to learn how to be a queen, Danae.
Oh, I don't know. Being the queen just means that you get what you want. I do that all the time anyway. I don't need a crown or an army for something as simple as that.
You're a very spoiled little girl, Your Majesty.
I know, and I love every minute of it.
Then the princess heard a faint, faraway murmur, a murmur that Mirtai could not, of course, even sense.
Why don't you go find Melodir? She suggested.
She sighed and rolled her eyes upward.
I'm sure she's looking for me anyway. It's probably time for another one of those girl lessons.
She's giving you instruction in courtly manners and traditional courtesies, Danae,
Mirtai reproved her.
If you're going to be a queen, you'll need to know those things.
I think it's silly myself. Go on ahead, Mirtai. I'll be along in a minute.
The giantess went off down the hall, and Princess Danae spoke very quietly.
What is it, Cetris?
She asked the empty air.
You already know the courtesies, Aphriel,
her curly-haired cousin said, appearing suddenly beside her. Why are you taking lessons?
It gives Melodir something to occupy her mind with, and keeps her out of mischief. I spent a great deal of time and effort getting her and Stregan together. I don't want her to spoil it by getting bored and starting to look for outside entertainment.
That's very important to you, isn't it? Cetra sounded a little puzzled. Why should the things they do to perpetuate themselves interest you at all?
You probably wouldn't understand, Cetris. You're too young.
I'm as old as you are.
Yes, but you don't pay attention to what your worshippers are doing when they're alone together.
I know what they're doing. It's ridiculous.
They seem to like it.
Flowers are much more dignified about it, he sniffed.
Is this what you wanted to talk to me about?
Oh, I almost forgot. I have a message for you. There's an Alcyon knight, one of the ones who serve me. I think you know him. He's a moon-faced fellow named Tinian.
Yes.
He went back to Kyrellos to pick up some help, and it seems that he inadvertently chose every Pandian skilled enough to pass messages on to you and brought them all to this part of the world. So there wasn't anybody with the church knights to tell you what happened in Zemok.
Yes, I already know about that. Annika's going to talk with Tinian about that. What happened in Zemok?
The church knights had an encounter with Clell. A third of them were killed. Aphriel unleashed a blistering string of curses.
Aphriel, he gasped, you're not supposed to talk that way. Oh, go bury it, Cetris. Why didn't you tell me about this as soon as you got here?
I was curious about the other thing, he confessed. It's not as if they all got killed, Aphriel. There are still plenty of them left. In a little while, there'll be as many as before. They're ferociously prolific.
I love them all, you dolt. I don't want to lose any of them. You're greedy. That's one of your shortcomings, cousin. You can't keep them all, you know. Don't make any wagers on that, Cetris. I'm only just getting started.
She threw her hands in the air.
This is impossible. You don't even understand the message you're trying to give me. Where are the church knights now?
They're coming across the steps of Central Astel to invade Seneska. They'll probably run into Clell again when they get there. I hope they don't all get killed.
Who's in command?
One of Romalic's servants, an old man called Abriel, was in charge when they left Kyrellos, but he got killed in Zemok. So one of the high priests of the Church of the Aline God, a Thalesian named Bergston, is giving orders now.
I should have guessed,
she said. I have a few things to take care of first. Then I'll go find Bergsten and get a true account of what happened. I was only trying to help.
Citrus sounded a little injured.
You did just fine, cousin.
Afriel forgave him.
It's not your fault that you haven't been keeping abreast of things here. I have important things on my mind, Afriel, he said defensively. Come by my studio sometime, he added brightly. I made a sunset the other day that's probably one of the best pieces I've ever done. It's so lovely that I've decided to keep it. Citrus, you can't just stop the sun that way. There's nobody living there, Afriel. They won't notice. Oh, dear.
She buried her face in her hands.
You're disappointed in me, aren't you?
His lower lip trembled slightly, and his large, luminous eyes filled with sudden tears.
And I try so hard to make you and the others proud of me. No, Citrus, she said. I still love you.
He brightened. Everything's all right then, isn't it?
You're a dear, Citrus. She kissed him. Run along now. I have to talk with these others. You will come and look at my sunset, won't you? Of course, cousin. Go along now.
She lifted her drowsing cap and blew into the furry creature's ear.
Wake up, Myrrh, she said.
The yellow eyes opened.
Go back to the place where we nest, the little princess said, speaking in cat. I have to do something.
She set Myrrh down on the floor, and the cat arched her back, hooking her tail into a sinuous question mark, and yawned. Then she padded off down the corridor. Denny looked around, probing with eyes and mind to make certain she was alone. There were human males knocking around the halls of this castle, and the appearance of a naked goddess always excited the males. It was flattering, of course, but it was also a little confusing for a being with a total lack of any reproductive urges. No matter how hard she tried, Afriel had never been able to understand how the mating impulse of human males could be so indiscriminate. The child goddess briefly resumed her true person, and then divided, becoming both little girls.
You're starting to get older, Danae, Flute noted. Does it show? Already? It's noticeable. You still have a way to go before you're fully mature, though. Are you really sure you want to go through with this? It might help us all to understand them a little better. I don't think Citrus even knows that it takes a male and a female to... Well, you know.
Danae blushed.
Citrus isn't overly bright. Can I borrow Mirtai? Flute asked. What for? You don't really need her here. And after what happened in Dirgis, I'd like to have somebody I trust to stand guard over Sophrenia. Good idea. Let's go talk with Sarabian and the others. They'll be able to send messengers to people we don't have any contacts with.
Flute nodded.
It would be so much more convenient if they were all ours.
Danae laughed.
I think Citrus was right. We are greedy, aren't we? We love them all, Danae. I don't see any reason why they can't love us.
The two little girls started off down the corridor hand in hand.
Danae, Flute said, do you think Mirtai might be afraid of heights?
He does look a lot like that picture Talon drew, doesn't he?
Tinian murmured to Ulaf.
Very close, Ulaf agreed. That boy has a tremendous talent.
Yes, he draws well, too.
Ulaf laughed shortly. Then he looked at the men clustered around Perok and drew Tinian a little farther away from them.
Perok's giving all the orders, he whispered, but the Arjunai in the flamboyant doublet speaks for King Rakia.
Sarabian's going to be very put out with the King of Arjun.
Ulaf nodded.
I wouldn't be at all surprised to see a new king on the throne before long.
What exactly did Perok say about Natayos? You couldn't have mistaken his meaning, could you?
Not a chance, Tinian. Just before he got into the argument with Duke Melanus, Perok said that Scarpa wanted to move his army out of Natayos before they gave Sparhawk the last note. I almost started cheering when he said that they were going to tell Sparhawk to go to Natayos for the exchange.
We'll have to be careful, though. They could be holding Aelana someplace else. They may not take her to Natayos until the last minute.
We'll find out for sure once Zanisha goes there.
Ulaf shrugged. The door to the book-lined room opened, and a liveried servant hurried in. An important message has arrived from Natayos, Baron, he told Perok. The messenger rode his horse half to death.
Horses are cheap. Send the fellow in.
I could learn to dislike that man, Tinian murmured.
I already do, Ulath replied.
He looked up speculatively.
We're sort of invisible, aren't we? He asked.
That's what the gnome says.
Can you imagine the expression Perak would get on his face if he suddenly got ripped up the front with an invisible knife?
Slowly, Tinian added. Very, very slowly. The messenger from the Taios was a shabbily dressed Dakite, and he was reeling with exhaustion as he staggered into the room.
Baron, he gasped, thank God I found you.
Speak up, man.
Could I have a drink of water?
Talk first.
Then you can drink anything you want.
Lord Scarpa ordered me to tell you that the man you've been watching isn't Sparhawk.
I see that Scarpa's finally gone completely mad.
No, Baron. Zelasta confirmed it. Somebody they call Clell went and had a look at this man you've been giving the notes to. They seem to think you'd know who this Clell fellow is. Anyway, he sent word that the man with a broken nose looks like Sparhawk, but it's not really him. This Clell must have some way to know for sure.
Perak began to swear sulphurously.
That tears it, Tinian growled. I'll pass this on to Afriel. We'd better get Barret and Khalad to safety.
Did Scarpa kill Sparhawk's wife?
Baron Perak asked the messenger.
No, my lord Baron. He was going to, but Zelasta stopped him.
I'm supposed to tell you not to do anything to let the impostor know that we're onto him. Zelasta needs some time to move the prisoners to some place that's safe. He wants you to continue as if nothing had happened. After he has those two women clear, he'll get word to you that it's all right to kill the man who's posing as Sparhawk.
Zelasta's in full command, then?
Yes, Baron Perak. Lord Scarpa's a bit, distraught, I suppose you might say.
You might say crazy, too. That'd be more accurate.
Perak started to pace the floor.
I wondered how much it would take to push Scarpa over the edge, he muttered. It's probably better this way. Zelasta's hysteric, but at least his head's on straight. Go back and tell him that I've received his message, and that I won't do anything to upset his plans. Let him know that I have no real fondness for Scarpa, and that I'll be completely loyal to him.
I will, my lord Baron.
Duke Melanus rose and crossed the room to close the window.
What in God's name is that awful smell? He exclaimed.
Tinian turned and saw the hulking troll standing just behind them.
Blockuff, he said, it is not good that you come into the dens of the man-things this way.
I was sent by Quadge, Tinian, Blockuff explained. Quadge grows tired of waiting. He wants to burn the wicked ones always.
Then their dim half-moment suddenly filled with smoke, and the enormous presence of the fire god was there.
Your hunt takes too long, Ulath from Thalesia. Have you found any of the wicked ones yet? If you have, point out which one it is. I will make it burn forever.
Tinian and Ulath exchanged a long look. Then Tinian grinned wolfishly.
Let's, he said.
Why don't we?
Ulath agreed. He looked at the flickering god of fire.
Our hunt has been successful, Quadge, he declared. We have found one of the ones who stole Annika's mate. You can make it burn forever now.
He paused.
There are others we also hunt, though, he added. We do not want to frighten them away so that they will be harder to hunt. Can Gnome put the one we have found into no time? You can burn it always there. When it burns in no time, the others of its herd will not smell the smoke or hear the crying out with hurt, and so they will not run away.
Your thought is good, Ulath from Thalesia, Quadge agreed. I will talk with Gnome about this. He will make it so that the one who burns always burns in the time which does not move. Which one of these should I burn?
That one,
Ulath replied, pointing at Baron Perak. Duke Melanus was turning from the window when he suddenly stopped, becoming a statue in mid-stride. Baron Perak continued his restless pacing.
We're going to have to start taking extra precautions,
he said, not yet realizing that the men around him were no longer moving. Then he turned and almost bumped into the exhausted messenger from Natayos.
"Get out of my way, idiot," he snapped.
The man did not move.
"I told you to take a message to Zalasta," Perak raged. "Why are you still here?"
He struck the messenger across the face and cried out in pain as his hand hit something harder than stone. He looked around wildly.
"What's the matter with all of you?"
he demanded in a shrill voice.
"What did it say?"
Quadge's voice was dreadful. Perak gaped at the vast troll god, shrieked, and ran for the door.
"It does not understand that it is now in no time," Ulath replied in trollish.
"It should know why it is being punished," Quadge decided. "Will it understand if you talk to it in the bird noises of the man-things?"
"I will make it understand," Ulath promised.
"It is good that you will. Speak to it."
Perak was hammering futilely on the immovable door.
"That won't do you any good, old boy," Ulath urbanely advised the terrified Dakite nobleman. "Things have definitely taken a turn for the worse for you, Baron. This large fellow with the smoke coming out of his ears is the troll god Quadge. He disapproves of your abduction of Queen Aelana."
"Who are you?" Perak half screamed. "What's going on here?"
"You've been brought to the place of punishment, Baron," Tinian advised him. "As my friend here just explained, Quadge is quite put out with you. Trolls are very moralistic. Things that we've come to take in stride, abductions, poisonings, and holding people for ransom, upset them enormously. There is one small advantage, though. You're going to live forever, Baron Perak. You'll never, ever die."
"What are you talking about?"
"You'll see."
"Does it understand now?"
Quadge demanded impatiently.
"It is our thought that it does," Ulath replied in trollish.
"Good."
Quadge implacably advanced on the cringing Dakite, extending one vast paw. Then he clapped it down on the top of Perak's head.
"Burn," he growled.
Baron Perak shrieked. Then his face seemed to split, and incandescent fire came spurting out through his skin. His doublet smoked for an instant, and then flashed into ashes. He shrieked again. His form was still the form of a man, but it was a form etched in flame. The Baron burned, unconsumed, and he danced and howled in agony. Quadge struck the immovable door with one huge paw, and the door burst outward in flaming chunks.
"Go," he roared. "Run! Run forever and burn always!"
The flaming Dakite fled, shrieking. The town of Arjun stood frozen in that eternal instant of perpetual now. The citizens, like statues, stood frozen stock still, unaware of the burning wraith that ran through their silent streets. They did not hear its agonized screams. They did not see it flee toward the lakeshore. Baron Perak ran, all ablaze, trailing greasy smoke. He reached the docks and fled in flames out a long pier stretching into the dark waters of the Sea of Arjun. He did not pause when he reached the end of the pier, but plunged off, yearning toward the quenching water. But, like the moment itself, the surface of the lake was unyielding and as hard as diamond. The wraith of flame howled in frustration, kneeling on the glittering surface and hammering on it, pleading to be let in, begging to drown in the blessed coolness just beyond reach. Then Perak leapt to his feet, driven by the troll god's awful command, shrieking still in agony. The man-shape of eternal flame ran out across the dark crystal surface, receding incandescent until it was no more than a single bright spark far out on the night-darkened lake. And its lost wail of pain and endless solitude came echoing back to the incurious shore.
"I wish Sparhawk would find his way home again," Talon muttered as he and Stragan once again climbed the rickety stairs to the loft. "We've got some fairly important information, and there's no way to pass it on to the others."
"There's nothing we can do about it right now," Stragan told him. "Let's see how Valish reacts to this story you cooked up. Keep it sort of vague until we see which way he jumps."
"And then will you teach me how to pick a pocket?"
Talon asked with overly feigned enthusiasm.
"All right,"
Strig inside.
I apologize. I'll concede that you know what you're doing.
Oh, thank you, Vimer, Talon gushed. Thank you, thank you.
You've been spending too much time with Princess Danae, Stragan muttered sourly. I hope she does marry you. You deserve it.
Bite your tongue, Stragan. I can still run faster than she can.
Running doesn't always help, Reldon. I thought I could run, too, but Melodir cut my legs out from under me with a single word.
Oh? Which word was that?
Prophet, my young friend. She waved unlimited amounts of gold in front of my face.
You sold out, Stragan, Talon accused. You betrayed every bachelor in the world for money.
Wouldn't you have? We're not talking about a few farthings here.
It's the principle of the thing, Talon replied loftily. I wouldn't sell out for money.
I don't think it'll be money that Danae's going to offer you, my innocent young friend. If you start running right now, you might escape. But I sort of doubt it. I knew your father, and there's a certain weakness in your family. Danae's going to get you, Talon. You don't have a chance.
Could we talk about something else? This is a very distressing sort of subject. Stragan laughed, and they went through the patched door at the top of the stairs. Valish sat in the faint light of his single candle, listening with a look of pained resignation on his face as Ogorajan babbled and drooled a long, strung-out series of disconnected phrases.
He doesn't seem to be getting any better, Stragan observed quietly
when he and Talon joined the two at the table.
He won't get better, Vimer, Valish sighed. I've seen this particular disease run its course before. Don't get too close to him. He's virulently infectious at this stage.
I certainly wouldn't want to catch what he's got.
Talon shuddered.
Do you have something for me?
Valish asked. I'm not going to swear to this, Master Valish, Talon said cautiously. The fellows I picked it up from weren't any too reliable. You might want to pass it on to Ponemdia, though. It concerns them rather directly, so they might want to take a few extra precautions.
Go on, Valish said.
Well, I overheard a couple of Arjunai soldiers talking in a tavern down by the waterfront. Real Arjunai soldiers, I mean. Not the ones Lord Scarpa's recruited. They were talking about some orders that just came in from the capital of Arjuna. From what I was able to gather, they've been ordered to prepare for an extended campaign out in the jungle. They think they're going to be mounting an attack on Lord Scarpa's camp at Ponemdia.
Impossible,
Valish snorted. They were saying that the orders came from King Rakia himself. The message had been sent to their officers, of course, so they probably garbled it. But they're convinced that the Arjunai army is going to attack Scarpa's forces. I just thought you ought to know.
Those soldiers were drunk, Reldon. King Rakia is our ally.
Really? What an amazing thing. He ought to let his troops know about it, then. The two I was listening to were positively drooling about all the loot they thought they were going to carry out of Ponemdia.
The queen is coming to Ponemdia,
Ogorajan suddenly sang in a wheezy voice to the tune of an old nursery song.
The queen is coming to Ponemdia.
Then he began to cackle in a high-pitched laugh. A look of sudden chagrin crossed Valish's face.
Calm yourself, Master Ogorajan, he said,
giving Stragan and Talon a worried look.
The queen is coming to Ponemdia, riding in a carriage.
Ogorajan sang in his cracked voice.
Don't pay any attention to him,
Valish said rather too quickly.
He's only babbling.
His mind really is slipping, isn't it?
Stragan noted.
Six white horses and silver wheels,
Ogorajan sang on.
Have you ever heard such gibberish?
Valish asked with a weak laugh.
Our presence must be disturbing him, Stragan said. Does he generally drift off to sleep later in the evening?
Usually.
Good. From now on, Reldon and I'll come by after midnight, when he's asleep.
I'd appreciate it, Vimer.
Valish looked at them, his face still worried.
He wasn't always like this, you know. It's the disease.
I'm sure of it. He's probably not even aware of what he's saying.
Exactly, exactly. He's completely out of his head. Why don't you two just forget his crazy singing?
Valish snatched his purse from his belt
and dug out several coins. Here, come by again after he's gone to sleep.
The two thieves bowed and quietly left.
Nervous, wasn't he? Talon said as they went back down the stairs.
You noticed. He even forgot himself and opened his purse.
They reached the bottom of the stairs.
Where to? Talon asked.
No place for the moment. Keep this to yourself, Talon.
Keep what?
But Stragan was already speaking in sonorous styric, weaving his fingers intricately in the air in front of him.
Talon stared as Stragan opened his hands palm up and made a sort of tossing gesture, rather like a man releasing a pigeon.
His eyes became distant, and his lips moved silently for a time. Then he smiled.
Surprised her, he said. Let's go.
What's going on here? Talon demanded.
I passed the things we just discovered along to Afriel.
Stragan shrugged. You? When did you learn Styric magic?
It's not really all that difficult, Talon.
Stragan grinned.
I've seen Sparhawk do it often enough, and I do speak Styric after all. The gestures were a little tricky, but Afriel gave me some instructions. I'll do it better next time.
How did you know it would work?
I didn't. I thought it was time I gave it a try, though. Afriel's very pleased with me.
You do know that you just volunteered to serve her, don't you? I know that much about her. You're her slave now, Stragan. She's got you.
Oh, well.
Stragan shrugged.
I suppose a man could do worse. Afriel's a thief herself, so I'm sure we'll get along.
He squared his shoulders.
Shall we go?
He suggested.
Chapter 18.
You're absolutely certain? Sparhawk eagerly asked the child goddess.
Colton is, she replied. He was walking past the building, and Aileen started to sing. He'd recognize her voice, wouldn't he?
Sparhawk nodded.
She could raise him from the dead by singing to him. How fast can you get me to Natayos?
Let's take the others to Dirges first. I want to fill Zanisha and Sophrenia in on what's been happening.
I already know about all that. I need to get to Natayos, Afriel.
All in good time, Sparhawk. It's not going to take us long to get to Dirges, and the others might have some useful ideas.
Afriel, he began to protest.
We'll do it my way, Sparhawk, she told him firmly. It won't take all that long, and it might give you enough time to get your temper under control. The others are waiting in the room with the map on the wall. Let's get them and go to Dirges.
There was one brief argument before they started.
I have no need of a horse, Betuana insisted,
tightening the lace on one of her half-boots. Afriel sighed.
Please do it my way, Betuana, she said.
I can run faster than a horse. Why burden myself with one?
Because you know how far it is from here to Dirges, and the horse doesn't. It's easier for me that way. Please, Betuana, just for me.
The child goddess looked appealingly at the armored Aton queen. Betuana laughed and gave in. And so they went out into the snowy courtyard, mounted, and rode out into the streets of Sarna. The sky was heavy with clouds that obscured the surrounding mountains, and it was spitting snow. They left town by way of the east gate, and slogged their way up the steep slope to the top of the gorge. Sparhawk, Itania, and Vanyan rode in the lead, breaking trail for the Queen of Aton, who rode wrapped in her heavy cloak, with the child goddess nestled in her arms. There was a strange dichotomy in the personality of the little divinity that troubled Sparhawk. He knew that she was wise beyond his ability to comprehend it, and yet she was still in most ways a little girl. Then he remembered the naked reality of the true goddess, and all hope of ever understanding her vanished.
"Can't we go any faster?" Vanyan demanded.
Sparhawk's friend had been in an agony of impatience ever since he had learned of the attack on Sophrenia, and Sparhawk had at times feared that he might have to physically restrain him.
"Fast or slow doesn't matter, Vanyan," he said. "We can run or crawl, and we'll still get there at just about the same time."
"How can you be so calm?"
"You get numb after a while,"
Sparhawk laughed wryly. It was perhaps a quarter of an hour later when they crested the top of that long hill and looked down at the town of Dirges, where the sun was shining brightly.
"That's incredible," Itania exclaimed.
Then he turned to look back down the trail they had just climbed, and his eyes suddenly went very wide.
"I asked you not to do that, Itania,"
Afriel reminded him.
"It's still snowing there," he choked, "but..."
He stared at the sun-drenched snowfield just ahead again.
"Why do people always want to stop right there?"
the little girl said irritably.
"Just move along, Itania. Once you've passed the crossover between the two places, it won't bother you anymore."
Itania resolutely set his face forward and rode on into the bright sunlight.
"Did you understand that, Sparhawk?"
he asked in a strained voice.
"Sort of. Do you really want to hear about what happens to you when you step through the place where 200 miles have just been abolished?"
Itania shuddered. They rode down the hill and entered the city.
"How much farther?"
Vanyan demanded.
"Just a little way," Sparhawk replied. "It's not all that big a town."
They rode through the narrow streets where the snow lay thickly piled against the sides of the buildings. They reached the inn, rode into the courtyard just behind it, and dismounted.
"Everything's been fixed now, Betwana,"
Afriel was assuring the Aton Queen.
"I'm keeping him in a deep sleep so that everything has a chance to knit back together again."
"Who's watching over him? Perhaps I should go there."
"No, Betwana," Afriel said firmly. "I don't have permission to take you there. Yet."
"But he's alone."
"Of course he's not alone. I'm right there beside him."
"But..."
Betwana stared at the little girl.
"Try not to think about it."
The child goddess pursed her lips thoughtfully.
"Engesa Eitan's a deceptive man, you know. Probably because he's so quiet. I didn't realize how remarkable he really is until I got into his mind."
"I have always known,"
Betwana said.
"How long will it be necessary to keep him away from me? Us?"
Afriel let the queen's slip pass without comment.
"A few weeks. I want to be sure that everything's healed. Let's go inside before Vanyan has apoplexy."
Sparhawk led them into the inn, where the innkeeper seemed to be so engrossed in wiping off a table that he was totally oblivious to anything else. They went up the stairs, and Sparhawk was startled to see Mirtai standing guard at Sophrenia's door.
"What are you doing here?"
he asked her.
"I thought you were back in Mytherian."
"I've been lent out," she replied, "like an old cloak."
"You know that's not true, Mirtai," Afriel said. "Danae's perfectly safe where she is, but I needed someone I could count on to guard Sophrenia. Let's go inside."
Sophrenia was sitting up in bed when they entered, and Zanisha was hovering protectively over her. The room was flooded with sunlight. Vanyan went directly to the woman he loved, knelt at her bedside, and gently put his arms around her.
"I'm never going to let you out of my sight again," he told her in a thick voice.
Sophrenia took his face between her hands and kissed him.
"You'll hurt yourself."
"Hush, Vanyan,"
she told him, embracing his head and holding his face fiercely against her body. Afriel's huge eyes were luminous with tears. Then she seemed to shake off her sudden emotion.
"Let's get started," she said crisply. "A great deal has happened since the last time we were all together like this."
"And all of it bad," Itania added in a gloomy voice.
"Not entirely," she said. "The worst of it is that Clell ambushed the church knights in the mountains of Zemok. He had those strange soldiers with him, and our friends lost almost half their number in killed and wounded."
"Good God!"
Itania groaned. Since Sparhawk already knew the details of recent events, his mind turned to the mystery of Clell's soldiers. He touched his fingertips to the bulge under his tunic.
"Blue Rose," he said in the silence of his mind. "I hear thee, Annika. Our friends have encountered Clell again. He hath brought warriors here from some other place."
"It was not unexpected. Clell is unsuited to direct engagement with humans by reason of his size."
"We are like mice in his eyes,"
Sparhawk surmised.
"Thou dost wrong thyself, Annika."
"Perhaps. These soldiers are not of this world, methinks. Their blood is yellow, and their faces are much like Clell's face."
"Ah," the voice said, "thou wilt recall that I once told thee that it is customary for Clell and me to contest with each other for possession of the various worlds I have caused to be?"
"Yes."
It pains me to admit this, Annika, but I have not always prevailed in these contests. Clell hath wrested some of my worlds from me. It is from one of those worlds, our Sarah would be my surmise, that he hath brought these creatures which thou and thy companions have met.
They are fearsome, Blue Rose, but not invincible. We have noted some evidence of distress in them during prolonged sojourns here.
I would be surprised, hadst thou not. The air of our Sarah would sear thy lungs, shouldst thou take but one breath of it. The air of this world is so sweet and wholesome that it may be most simply assimilated by thy kind and other creatures here. The creatures of our Sarah are not so fortunate. Their means of assimilating the noxious miasmas of their home are far more complex than thy simple means of suspiration. Moreover, that which would be lethal to thee hath become necessary for them. I am certain that they find thine air thin and unsatisfying by comparison.
And deadly? Sparhawk pressed.
In time, most certainly.
Wouldst thou venture a surmise as to how much time it might take our air to kill them?
Thou art savage, Annika.
I am outnumbered, Blue Rose. The warriors of Clell put our cause in direst peril. We must know how long they can survive here.
That will vary from warrior to warrior. No more than a day, certainly, and exertion will hasten the process.
I thank thee, Blue Rose. My companions and I will devise tactics to use this information to best advantage.
Pay attention, Sparhawk, Afriel told him.
Sorry, he apologized. I was conferring with our friend.
He patted the bulge at his front. He looked at Danyan.
I picked up some more information about the weakness of Clell's soldiers, he said. You and I need to work out some tactics.
Venya nodded. Are you sure Barret and Khalad are all right? Sophrenia asked the little girl. Afriel nodded. Zelasta doesn't want us to know that he's found out that we were deceiving him. He's given orders to everyone to behave as if nothing's happened. She thought a moment. I guess that's about all, she said. Brigston's coming across the steps. Calton, Bevier, and Kaalador are already in the tiles. And Ulaf, Tinian, and their pet troll will be there before long.
Can you get word to the Emperor? Itania asked her. He should know that the King of Arjuna's in league with Scarpa.
I'll take care of it, she promised. Then she frowned slightly. Sophrenia, she said, have you been giving Stragan instruction in the secrets?
No. Why?
He cast the spell of the secret summoning. He didn't do it very well, but he got my attention.
How in God's name did he learn that? Vanyan exclaimed,
still holding Sophrenia in his arms. Probably from watching the rest of you. Stragan's very quick, and he does speak Styric. Stealing secrets is almost the same as picking pockets, I guess. Anyway, it was Stragan who told me about Scarpa's other forts. He and Talon are planting false stories with that Dacite in order to confuse the other side.
Methinks it is time for me to go to Natayos, Zanisha said. We must verify the presence there of Annika's queen and make preparations for her rescue.
Before Zelasta tries to move her, Sparhawk added. I'd better go along as well. The others are there already, and Calton might need a firm hand to keep him from doing anything rash. Besides, if Elana and Aileen are there, we might just as well pull them out of danger. Then I'll disperse Scarpa's army, and we'll go have a talk with Sirgon. And Zelasta, Vanyan added bleakly.
Oh, by the way, Afriel said, is anybody keeping a list of the people we want to do things about? If you are, you can scratch off Baron Perak's name.
Did Ulaf kill him? Sparhawk guessed.
Oh, he isn't dead, Sparhawk. You see, when Quadge started pushing Ulaf and Tinian for information about the people who'd abducted Elana, they gave him Perak.
What happened? Itania asked.
Gnome froze time.
She shrugged.
Then Quadge set fire to Perak. He's completely engulfed in flame. He's still running, and he'll run and burn in that empty, unmoving instant for all eternity.
Dear God!
Itania choked in horror. I'll pass that on to Quadge, Itania, the child goddess promised. I'm sure he'll be pleased that you approve.
The air was cool and dry, and the sky was peculiarly gray. Tinian and Ulath rode out of Arjun in frozen time, with Blakath shambling along between their horses.
How long would you say it's going to take us to reach Natayos?
Tinian asked.
Oh, Ulath replied, I don't know. A couple of seconds, probably.
Very funny.
I rather liked it.
Ulath looked up at the flock of birds hanging in midair overhead.
I wonder if a man ages at all when he's walking around in this no time.
I don't know. You could go ask Baron Perak, I suppose.
I doubt that he'd be very coherent.
Ulath scratched at one bearded cheek.
I'm definitely going to shave this thing off. And if Gerda doesn't like it, that's just too bad.
Then he thought of something he had been meaning to ask their shaggy friend.
Blakath, he said.
Yes, Ulath?
It makes us sad that our hunt takes us to the lands of the sun where the heat causes hurt to you.
It causes no hurt to me, Ulath. There is no heat or cold in no time.
Ulath stared at him.
You are sure? He asked incredulously.
Do you feel heat?
Blakath asked simply.
No.
Ulath admitted.
I do not. It had been my thought.
He broke off, frowning and trying to frame his next question in coherent trollish.
We were far to the north when you and your packmates ate the children of Sirgon, who were both dead and not dead.
Yes, it was north from where we are now.
Then Gnome took you and your packmates into no time.
Yes.
Then Gworg led you to the lands of the sun.
Yes.
There was no hurt caused to you when he did this?
No. The hurt was caused by the things that were not how they should be.
Which things were not how they should be?
All of the trolls were in one pack. This is not how it should be. Troll packs do not have so many. It is not a good way to hunt.
Blakath rubbed at his shaggy face with one massive paw.
We did not hunt this way when we were in the troll range where we are supposed to be. My thought was that Gworg's mind was sick when he came to us and told us to cross the ice which never melts to come to this place. It was not Gworg who did this. It was Sirgon. Sirgon had made himself to look like Gworg and spoke in Gworg's voice. It was my mind which was sick. My thought should have told me that it was not Gworg.
Does it cause hurt to you that the trolls are all one pack?
Much hurt, Ulath. I do not like it when things are not how they should be. I have known Grek for many snows. His pack hunts near my pack in the troll range. I do not like Grek. It has been in my thought for the past two snows to kill him. Gworg will not let me kill him. This causes hurt to me.
It will not be this way always, Blakath, Ulath said consolingly. After we have killed all of Sirgon's children, the gods will take the trolls back to the troll range. Then things will be how they should be again.
It will make me glad when they are. I would really like to kill Grek.
Blakath shambled away mournfully.
What was that all about?
Tinian asked.
I'm not sure, Ulath admitted. I'm groping around the edges of something here. I know it's right in front of me, but I can't put my finger on it.
For the moment, let's just hope that the troll gods can control the homicidal impulses of their children,
Tinian said fervently.
Trollicidal, Ulath corrected.
What?
You said homicidal. Blakath wants to kill Grek. Grek's a troll. The right word would be trollicidal.
That's petty quibbling, Ulath.
Right is right, Tinian,
Ulath replied in a faintly injured tone. It was still quite early the next morning when Athliel returned from Sarna. The sky to the east was lighted with the pale approach of day, even though the moon still held sway above the western horizon. Sparhawk and Zanisha had been waiting for no more than half an hour when they heard the familiar trill of flute's pipes coming from back in the dark forest.
That was quick, Sparhawk said as the child goddess joined them.
It's not as if Sarna were on the other side of the continent, Sparhawk, she replied. I got them all settled in.
She smiled.
Vanyan's being a pest, He was trying to make Sophronia go to bed when I left.
She has been very weak, Afriel, he reminded her.
But she isn't now. She needs to be up and moving about. Turn your backs.
Zanisha looked puzzled.
It's one of her quirks, Sparhawk explained. She doesn't want people watching while she changes.
He looked at the child goddess.
Don't forget the clothes this time, Afriel, he told her. Let's not offend the Anorae.
You're so tiresome about that, Sparhawk. Now please turn around.
It only took a few moments.
All right,
Afriel said. They turned.
Sparhawk noted the goddess was once again garbed in that satiny white robe.
Thou art fair beyond description, divine one,
Zanisha said. Afriel shrugged.
I cheat a lot. Do you trust me, Anorae? With my life, divine Afriel. I hope you're taking notes, Sparhawk.
Have you arranged for some noise to hide what you're doing from Zalasta?
I don't have to. Zanisha's coming along, and her presence will conceal everything.
I suppose I hadn't thought of that, he admitted.
Now then, Anorae, Afriel explained, we're all going to hold hands. Then we'll rise up into the air. It's really better if you don't look down. As soon as we get above the tops of these mountains, we'll start moving. You won't feel any wind or cold or sense of movement. Just hold on to my hand and try to think of something else. It won't take very long. She squinted toward the eastern horizon. We'd better get started. I'd like to get us to Natayos and into a good hiding place before Scarpa's soldiers start stirring around. She held out her hands, and Sparhawk and Zanisha took them. Sparhawk steeled himself and watched the ground rapidly receding as they rose swiftly toward the dawn sky.
You're squeezing, Sparhawk, Afriel told him.
Sorry, I'm still not entirely used to this.
He looked at Zanisha. The Anorae, all aglow, was a picture of absolute serenity as they rose higher and higher.
The world is fair,
she said softly, with a note of wonder in her voice.
If you get high so that you can't see the ugliness,
Afriel smiled.
I come up here to think now and then. It's one place where I can be fairly sure I won't be interrupted.
She took a bearing on the newly risen sun, which had seemed almost to rush up into the sky as they rose, set her face resolutely toward the southeast, and gave a peculiar little nod. The earth beneath began to flow smoothly, rushing toward them from the front and receding just as rapidly behind.
It seemeth me a merry way to travel,
Zanisha observed. I've always rather liked it, Afriel agreed. It's certainly faster than plodding along on horseback. They fled southeasterly with an eerie kind of silence around them.
The Sea of Arjun, Sparhawk said, pointing toward a large body of water off to the right.
So small,
Zanisha said.
I had thought it larger.
We're up quite a ways, Afriel explained. Everything looks small from a distance.
They sped on and were soon over the dense green jungle that covered the southeastern coast of the continent.
We'll go down a bit now, Afriel warned. I'll take a bearing on Dilo, and then we'll swerve toward the southwest to reach Natayos. Will we not be seen from the ground?
Zanisha asked.
No, although it's an interesting idea. Your light would definitely startle people. Whole new religions could be born if people on the ground started seeing angels flying over their heads. There's Dilo.
The port city looked like a child's toy carelessly left on the shore of the deep blue Tamil Sea. They veered to the southwest, following the coastline and gradually descending. Afriel was peering intently down at the jungle rushing back beneath them.
There,
she said triumphantly. The ruin might have been more difficult to find had not the northern quarter been cleared of the brush and trees which covered the rest of the ancient city. The tumbled gray stones of the half-fallen buildings stood out sharply in the light of the sunrise, and the newly cleared road stretching toward the north was a yellow scar cut deeply into the face of the dark green of the jungle. They settled gently to earth on the road about a quarter of a mile north of the ruins, and Sparhawk immediately led them back 100 paces into the thick undergrowth. He was tense with excitement. If Colton was right, he was less than a mile from the place where Elana was being held captive.
Go ahead, Zanisha, Afriel suggested. I want to look you over before you go into the city. This is important, but I don't want to put you in any danger. Let's be sure nobody can see you.
thou art overly concerned, divine one. Over the centuries, we of the Delphi have perfected this particular subterfuge.
She straightened, and her face assumed an expression of almost unnatural calm. Her form seemed to shimmer, and little rainbow flickers of light seethed beneath her plain homespun robe. She blurred and wavered, her form becoming indistinct. Then she was only an outline, and Sparhawk could clearly see the trunk of the tree behind her.
"How do you make the things on the other side of you visible?"
Afriel asked curiously.
"We bend the light, divine one. That is at the core of this deception. The light flows around us like a swift-moving stream, carrying with it the images of such objects as our bodies would normally obscure."
"Very interesting," Afriel mused.
"I hadn't even thought of that possibility." "We must be wary, however," Zenisha told the goddess. "Our shadows, like telltale ghosts, can betray us."
"That's simple. Stay out of the sunlight."
Sparhawk concealed a faint smile. Even a goddess could give blatantly obvious instructions sometimes.
"I shall most carefully adhere to thine advice, divine one,"
Zenisha replied with exaggerated calm.
"You are making fun of me, aren't you, Zenisha?" "Of course not, divine Afriel."
Even the outline was gone now, and Zenisha's voice seemed to come out of nowhere.
"To work with all," she said,
her sourceless voice receding in the direction of the road.
"I shall return anon."
"I'll have to compliment Eudamus," Afriel said. "That's a very clever means of concealment. Turn around, Sparhawk. I'm going to change back."
After the child goddess had resumed the familiar form of flute, she and Sparhawk made themselves comfortable and waited as the sun gradually rose. The jungle steamed, and the air was alive with the chattering of birds and the buzzing of insects. The moments seemed to drag. They were so close to Aelana that Sparhawk almost imagined that he could smell her familiar fragrance. "Are Ulath and Tinian here yet?" he asked, more to get his mind away from his anxious concern than out of any real curiosity.
"Probably," Flute replied. "They set out from Arjun yesterday morning. It probably seemed like 3 weeks to them, but it was no more than a heartbeat for everybody else."
"I wonder if they stayed in no time, or just merged into Scarpa's army."
"It's hard to say. Maybe I should have checked before Zenisha left."
Then they heard several men talking on the road. Sparhawk crept closer, with Afriel just behind him.
"Because I don't trust these soldiers, Ka," a rough-looking fellow was saying to a blonde Aline.
"It's daytime, Senga. Nobody's going to ambush your beer wagons in broad daylight."
"You can't be too careful. Money's running short here in the Tiles, and that beer's the lifeblood of my business. A thirsty man who's running short of money might do anything."
"Have you considered lowering your prices?"
an evil-looking fellow with a black eye patch asked.
"Bide your tongue, Shalag," Senga replied.
"Just a suggestion."
The patch-eyed man shrugged as the dozen or so heavily armed men moved on out of earshot.
"You recognized them, of course,"
Afriel murmured to Sparhawk.
"Carlton and Bevier, yes. I didn't see Kaalador, though."
He thought for a moment.
"Will you be all right here? Alone, I mean?"
"Well, it's awfully dangerous, Sparhawk. Lions and tigers and bears, you know."
"It was a silly question, wasn't it?"
"I'd say so, yes. What have you got in mind?"
"Carlton and Bevier are obviously working for that fellow they called Senga. I think I can get them to vouch for me. They seem to have the run of Natayos, so hiring on as a beer guard would give me a way to get into the city without attracting attention."
"Will you be able to restrain yourself when you're that close to Mother?"
"I'm not going to do anything foolish, Afriel."
"Well, I suppose it's all right. You have my permission."
"Oh, thank you, divine Afriel," he said. "Thank you, thank you, thank you."
"You have a very clever mouth, Sparhawk," she said tartly.
"It's probably the clever company I've been keeping lately."
He shrugged.
"I have to run back to Sarna for a little while," Afriel told him. "Try to stay out of trouble when you get into the city."
"I'll miss you desperately."
He grinned.
"You're in an odd humor today."
"I feel good. If all goes well, I'll have your mother out of there before the sun goes down."
We'll see.
They waited as the sun crept farther up in the eastern sky. Then, from off to the north, they heard the approach of several heavily laden wagons.
I'll keep you posted, Sparhawk promised,
and he stepped out of the bushes to stand at the side of the muddy road. The first wagon, drawn by four patient oxen, came creaking around a bend. The wagon bed was piled high with barrels, and the one known as Senga sat on the seat beside the villainous-looking driver. Carlton, his expression oddly familiar on his altered face, was perched on top of the barrels.
Ho, Carl, Sparhawk called from the roadside. I thought I recognized your voice when you passed here a little while ago.
Well, strike me blind if it isn't Fran,
Carlton exclaimed with a broad grin. Sparhawk suddenly wondered what might have happened if Carlton hadn't recognized him. Carlton was laughing now with genuine delight.
We all thought you'd run away to sea when things came apart on us back in Matherian.
It didn't work out.
Sparhawk shrugged.
There was a bosun on board who was a little too free with his whip. He decided to swim for shore one dark night. I can't imagine what came over him. We were 20 leagues out to sea when I helped him over the side.
People do strange things sometimes. What are you doing here?
I heard about this army, and I thought it might be a good place to hide. Word's going about that this Scarpa fellow plans to attack Matherian. I've got a few old scores to settle there, so I decided to tag along for fun and profit.
I think we can find a better spot for you than back in the rear ranks of Scarpa's army.
Carlton nudged Senga's shoulder with his foot.
The fellow standing ankle-deep in the mud there is an old friend of ours from Matherian, he told the tavern keeper. His name's Fran, and he's a very good man in a fight. When the police jumped on us back in Matherian, he stood shoulder to shoulder with Shalon, holding them off while the rest of us got away.
Do you think there might be a spot for him in your operation here in the Tayos?
Do you vouch for him, Tal? Senga asked. I couldn't ask for better help if trouble crops up.
You're in charge of security, Senga shrugged. Hire anybody you want.
I was hoping you'd see it that way.
Carlton beckoned to Sparhawk.
Climb on up, Fran, he said. I'll show you the wonders of Natayos.
From the top of a beer wagon? Can you think of a better place?
Chapter 19 Kring arrived in Sarna late in the afternoon of the same day in which Afriel had transported Sophrenia and the others there from Dirges. Mirtai calmly went down into the courtyard of the Aton garrison to meet her bandy-legged betrothed. The two of them embraced rather formally, and then came into the building.
She seems very restrained,
Vanyan observed quietly to Betwana, as the two watched from the window of the conference room.
It is not seemly to openly display affection in public, Vanyan Preceptor, the queen replied. Decorum must be maintained, even though the heart might prefer it otherwise.
Ah!
Ho, friend Vanyan, Kring said as he and his tall beloved entered. You're just the man I was looking for.
It's good to see you too, friend Kring. How are things going in Samar?
It's quiet. The Seneskins have pulled back from the border. Is there something going on to the south that I haven't been told about?
Not that I know of. Why do you ask?
The Seneskins were massing just across the border, and we were expecting them to come across to lay siege to Samar almost any time. Then, several days ago, they pulled back and left only a few units in place. The rest of their army marched south.
Why would they do that?
Vanyan asked, frowning.
Probably to meet the church knights,
Afriel replied. Vanyan turned to see the child goddess calmly sitting in her usual place on Sophrenia's lap. She had not been there a moment before. There was no point to making an issue of it. Afriel would never change.
The church knights aren't coming from that direction, Divine One, he said.
We know that, Vanyan, she replied, but Stragan and Talon have been busy in Baressa. They've managed to convince that Dacite spy that there's a huge fleet of ships flying church flags knocking about in the Gulf of Daconia. Evidently, the Dacite passed the word on, and the Seneskan High Command took it seriously enough to send their main force south to defend southern Seneska.
But they know that the church knights are coming overland through Astel.
They know about that force, Lord Vanyan, Itanya said. But they must have been convinced that there's another coming by sea.
There aren't that many of us, Itanya.
You and I know that, Lord Vanyan, but it's generally believed here in Tamale that there are at least 1 million of you fellows. The term church knights conjures up visions of armies stretching from horizon to horizon. Vanyan frowned.
Oh, he said finally, I think I understand. During the Zemok Wars, we joined forces with the armies of the kings of Eosia. The Tamil observers must have thought that everyone in armor was a church knight.
I think I'll have a talk with the Emperor, Itanya mused. Titles of nobility might be in order for your pair of thieves. This imaginary fleet of theirs seems to have pulled half the Senescan army off the border, and most likely pinned down the Arjunais as well.
It's a great little fleet, Vanyan grinned, and you don't even have to feed the sailors. Let's keep the stories alive.
He looked at Afriel. Could you arrange some illusions, Divine One? Dragons? Flights of angels?
How about 1,000 ships hull down on the horizon instead?
What do I get in return?
Stop teasing, Sophrenia told her with a gentle smile. Where would you like your make-believe boats, Vanyan?
He thought about it.
Why don't you just bounce them up and down the coastline of Daconia and western Arjuna, he suggested. Let's run the Senescans and Arjunais ragged trying to position themselves to defend against landings.
I'll go take care of it right now, she said, slipping down from her sister's lap, before I forget.
When did you ever forget anything? Sophrenia smiled.
I don't know. I must have it sometime, though. I've probably forgotten exactly when.
She gave them all an impish little smile, and then she vanished. Kring was sitting at Mirtai's side, and he had been squinting speculatively at the ceiling, absently running one hand over his stubbled scalp. He was not free to use the other, since Mirtai had taken possession of it. Her contented, almost placid expression clearly said that she did not intend to release his hand in the foreseeable future.
If Divine Afriel can keep those Senescan troops more or less permanently distracted, Takumi and I'll be able to hold Samar without any help, the Domi said, particularly now that we know how to deal with Quell's soldiers.
He rubbed even more briskly at his scalp. Quit worrying at it, Mirtai told him. I'll shave you just as soon as we finish here.
Yes, love, he agreed immediately. Oh. That reminds me, Vanyan said. Sparhawk had a talk with Bellium. Quell's soldiers can only breathe our air for about 1 day before they start dying, and exertion speeds up the process. If you come across them again, keep them running.
Kring nodded. A tall Eton came in and murmured something to Itanya.
I'm really awfully busy right now, old boy, Itanya objected.
He's most insistent, Itanya Ambassador.
Oh, very well. Itanya rose to his feet. I'll be right back, Lord Vanyan, he said, and followed the Eton from the room.
Did Sparhawk find out what country Quell's soldiers come from, friend Vanyan? Kring asked. I'd sort of like to avoid that place.
I don't think you need to worry, Domi Kring. Sophrenia smiled. Quell's soldiers were brought here from some place beyond the stars.
End of Side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.